Hello and welcome to the Decrypting Crypto Podcast. It's April 18th, 2024, and this is Off-Chain, your weekly recap of the biggest stories in the crypto space. I'm Matthew House-Barbie, and as always, I am here back once again with Austin Knight. How you doing, Austin?
Doing well, Matt. Glad we're back at it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not much going on. We're a day away from a pretty important day in the world of Bitcoin and crypto. And, you know, we're projecting that the Bitcoin halving is happening tomorrow, so around about 4-ish p.m. UTC time. I know we're going to be digging into that today, so it's going to be, I mean, it's exciting. And it's kind of come around all of a sudden and real quick. So I'm excited to dig into that, which I know you're going to be talking a bunch about that, Austin. And I'm going to be digging into something that's kind of halving related, but is an exciting trend that's about to explode upon the halving, which is the introduction of runes on Bitcoin. And if you are familiar with some of our previous episodes that we've done on ordinals, and then if you've heard of BRC20s, this is an expansion on that. So I think we've got quite a lot of exciting stuff to talk about today.
Yeah, let's get right into it.
All right, let's do it. What the heck are runes? Well, you know, we did a real deep dive episode around the launch of ordinals, which, you know, for all intents and purposes, you can think of those as NFTs on Bitcoin. And we did that back in, I think it was February 2023. And around that time, I was wondering whether this is going to be a flash in the pan. I felt like there was something there, but I honestly didn't know if it would take off. Well, yeah, it took off all right. And, you know, most of the largest NFT projects by market cap now are Bitcoin related. So, and from ordinals, should I say. So we've got the, and coming back to that, right? So Casey Rodama was the creator of ordinals, and he is also the creator of the runes protocol. And that's what we're going to be giving a bit of an introduction to today, because I think that one, it's an interesting kind of project from a technical side. And two, despite whatever price action we see on Bitcoin through the halving, this is going to have a lot of attention, capital flowing into it, and speculation surrounding it. So I think it's an interesting place to play around over the next few days, weeks, and months ahead. So let's just like start from the beginning, right? So runes and the runes protocol is a fungible token protocol that's built on Bitcoin. As I mentioned before, if you're familiar with ordinals, and more specifically inscriptions, which is the name that's given basically for NFTs on that align with the ordinals theory, ordinals and inscriptions are effectively NFTs on Bitcoin. Runes, on the other hand, are the equivalent of like ERC20 tokens from Ethereum. So, you know, this is basically, if we have to distill this down, and what it's probably going to be, is meme coins on Bitcoin. If that wasn't a compelling use case, I don't know what is, Austin. So, you know, there we have it.
My favorite.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it is going to create an explosion of in particular speculation in the short term around a lot of this. So there have already been a few protocols that have launched that have tried and have attempted to create kind of fungible tokens on Bitcoin. And the probably most, the one of like most note is BRC20s. So BRC20 is effectively kind of like tapping into, it's part of ordinals, using inscriptions to create kind of fungible like tokens. It's pretty clunky, if I'm completely honest, and not the most user-friendly. Not to say that Runes is going to be perfectly user-friendly. I don't think that will be the case. However, I think that it's going to be a slightly more elegant implementation. So I think the key thing, right, with Runes is it's solving a problem in that it's a much more scalable solution than BRC20 and other ordinals-based fungible token protocols. And the main reason for this is due to it being a UTXO-based kind of protocol and not requiring new inscriptions to be created every time you want to transfer coins. Now, that was a lot of technical jargon, but what that actually means is that it's going to dramatically reduce the load on Bitcoin blocks. You may remember, as the ordinals kind of craze kicked off, we saw these like insane fees just rising up on the Bitcoin network, and that was because there was a huge amount of congestion happening on the network. And it's really all down to the way that ordinals work. They create a lot of bloat. You can say what you like about that. Maybe it's good it creates more fees for miners. Maybe it's bad because, you know, the whole fucking blockchain grinds to a halt. That's not great. but some would call it a stress test. I mentioned this acronym UTXO, and I think this is something that you'll hear a lot more. It stands for unspent transaction output, and this is the technique that the Bitcoin protocol, as well as a few other protocols, actually very different to the way that Ethereum works, to track balances as they move between crypto wallets. So imagine it like this, right? So think about UTXOs as almost like, I hear them described as like unspent kind of change in your pocket, right? So the way that you actually run a transaction through Bitcoin, the way this works and has always worked and will continue to probably always work, is that when you want to send and transfer tokens, let's say I want to transfer, 0.2 Bitcoin to you, Austin. Maybe I'm feeling very generous today. And what might happen here is that, you know, a transaction is created and 0.5 Bitcoins go into the input of that transaction. 0.2 of those are then split out and sent into yours. And then the remaining 0.3 are then pushed back into my wallet. So they kind of like take an input that's larger than the amount that needs to be sent, breaks that out into different UTXOs, and then one is stored in back in my wallet, the other is spent into yours. So this is kind of the way that Runes works right now, in that if we get into like the technical piece, and I'll do a little comparison to how this differs from BRC20s, right? So the way the Runes protocol works is it starts with an issuance transaction. So if you think about ERC20 tokens on Ethereum, any like altcoin, take your pick, right? They're coded up into a smart contract, and you have all the different parameters like the supply, the ticker name, all of this stuff. Well, for the Runes protocol, at the issuance stage, you kind of set all of the parameters for the Rune token being issued, like that symbol, total supply, number of decimal places, etc. Right, and this information is assigned to a very specific UTXO, and that UTXO can contain any amount and any number of runes. And this is kind of one of the ways that Runes avoids creating congestion in the Bitcoin network, because you can slot multiple runes into one UTXO, whereas with BRC20s, you have to like basically do individual inscriptions. Actually, I think something like 3 inscriptions have to take place just to even transfer, to process a transfer on BRC20s, which is 3 individual Bitcoin transactions. It's just a lot of bloat that happens here, right? Now, when the transactions are transferred, the Runes protocol splits like a single UTXO into multiple new UTXOs. They hold different amounts of the tokens. Let's say it's like 500 tokens in one UTXO, 1,000 tokens in the other UTXO. and they're then sent to the recipients. This is just like how when you're transferring bitcoins, right? Now, the information about the runes token is stored within the OP return function. This is data that's directly embedded into BTC transactions. So it can be done all on chain. And the big difference here, right, is like, this is really lean because the OP return field is like a very small amount of information can be stored on that, 80 bytes in total. BRC20s and like actually just ordinals inscriptions overall can store, they get stored in the witness kind of metadata location, which can hold up to 4 megabytes. And this is where we've seen, for example, an entire Doom game emulator being embedded into a single Bitcoin transaction of like nearly like 3 megabytes, which is quite heavy and bloated to push. Whereas you're just in the OP return field of runes, you're just sharing some like text data on, you know, the parameters around the actual token itself. It's much leaner. This is like another like major difference between like fungible token protocols on Bitcoin, which often have to do part of all of this just off chain. Like for example, in ordinals, a lot of like the information around ordinals is done actually like mapped off chain versus all being stored in Bitcoin itself. So this is just better for reducing network congestion, and is a really important piece here. And I think, you know, some of the things that I was mentioning around a lot of this is it's just honestly so much less clunky, and this has more scalability to it. It's not perfect. It's definitely not as elegant as like ERC20 tokens that are done on Ethereum and equivalents across other blockchains. But in terms of like where we are today on Bitcoin, this is going to help people both spin up new tokens and, more importantly, transfer them with very minimal bloat. So I think it's just going to enable more transferability and trading to happen without as much of a burden on the Bitcoin blockchain. And just as well, there's a lot of additional terminology that comes into runes, as is always the case. Like, for example, the actual like messages that store information about about a rune is called rune stones. And then you have like the actual process that's of issuing a new rune token is known as etching, right? And there's a bunch of other stuff. Then you have minting.
Can you like collect all of your rune stones and maybe turn them into a runescape?
Oh, maybe. Who knows?
What is happening?
This is like, honestly, I love the stuff that like Casey has built. I feel like he's also just like fucking with us a little bit with all of this like ridiculous terminology to make it even more complicated. But there is something to this in that I remember when I was first digging into ordinals and I was just like, am I actually losing my mind? Like, this is just so obscenely complicated. But, you know, wherever there is challenges to being able to like gain access to something, or where things are overly complicated from a technological point of view, especially in crypto, usually there's real value to persevering and being able to get early access to some of this stuff. The important thing with a lot of this, right, with runes, is there's going to be interfaces that basically abstract all of this information away, and you're just going to be able to, you know, press buy a token, press sell a token. But it is important to understand like how some of this works and the implications and the limitations, because it isn't so straightforward. But why am I even talking about this today, right? So the most notable thing here is that the runes protocol, it's not live yet, but it's about to go live. It's about to go live in about 24 hours at block 840,000, which is at the BTC halving. And there are a lot of projects that are launching runes. There is a race to be like the first 10 runes to have dropped. And I think there'll be provenance that is assigned to those projects that do this. There's many projects actually airdropping runes right after the halving. And to be eligible for those, you often need to like either be holding one of their like ordinals inscriptions, their Bitcoin NFTs, or BRC20 token, or otherwise, that basically gets like not converted, but you know, imagine you hold one of the, for example, a confusingly, the one of the biggest ordinals projects right now is called Runestones, which is not related or directly affiliated to the Runes protocol or the specific terminology used within it. However, it is the whole purpose of the project, which was set up by one of the big thought leaders in the ordinal space, Leonardis. He's been working closely with Casey as well on a lot of this stuff. But this is a project where he'd airdropped a runestone inscription, so one of these Bitcoin NFTs, to quite a lot of people. I actually ended up getting one of these, I think, for holding. I think you had to like hold three inscriptions in your wallet of any inscription, and then you got this, right? And at the time of the halving, then there will be a rune token that they'll be deploying that will go to all runestone holders. And there's loads of projects like this, right? So if you may be wondering, like, okay, well, what's the deal? How do you get involved? What's going to happen? I think what we're going to see is there's going to be an explosion of these rune tokens that go out. Some of these will gain a bunch of traction. You'll probably see some do like crazy 100x's. You'll also see some go to absolute zero, right? So this is going to be a wild ride. So strap in if you're going to play in this space and know that it is uncharted territory. If you want to get runes, right, the first thing you're going to need is a Bitcoin wallet, obviously. But I would personally use something like Unisat, which I use Unisat wallet because it supports ordinals and other BRC20s, or Xverse, which also is like one of the others that has a load of support for this. So just maximizing the chances that they're going to have support for like the wider ecosystem. Of those projects that are confirmed airdrops, I think actually Magic Eden has a section now that's like pre-rune tokens or something like that where you can see this, but probably some of the biggest are like RSIC, RSIC, Runestone, Pizza Ninjas, Rune Pups. There's loads. You'll be able to go and actually trade runes. Magic Eden is going to be doing that out the gate. Unisat actually have their own marketplace that I know will be listing runes, and then I'm sure a bunch will follow. And so have a little look, maybe play around, don't go crazy. This is going to be a bit of a roller coaster, but I think it is interesting. It is going to create a lot more activity on Bitcoin, whether the laser eyes community will like it or not. I'm sure they won't because they hated ordinals, but hey, it drove a ton of fees and has clearly proved out a use case for Bitcoin outside of its initial mission, which is cool, I think. I'm all for it. The real question here is like, you know, will the hype last? And I asked the same question when we talked about inscriptions back in Feb 2023. If you haven't listened to the Ordinals deep dive episode that we did, go back and have a look at that because you'll see the progress that's been made since then. A lot of great developments have been made, but you can kind of get a deep dive into how it all works. But, you know, looking back to where we are today, inscriptions have been a huge hit. That Runestone project I was talking about flipped Bored Apes, you know, for market caps, massive. So, and that's only, I think Bitcoin as a by market cap of NFTs is only going to grow. I wasn't a big fan of BRC20 tokens, and I'm still not convinced on them. Runes, though, could potentially be the answer here. I still think that inscriptions like Bitcoin NFTs are going to be the primary focus. Runes will likely have a lot of capital flooding into them in the short term at least. And then I think if Bitcoin DeFi really takes off, they could play a bigger role long term. But my guess here is that most of the big ordinals projects will probably do some like airdrops of their own rune token to their holders, stuff like that. So stay safe, kids, but it'll be a fun place to play around.
Well, the countdown is on. You've got 24 hours-ish to learn about runes before they become a real thing in the ecosystem with the halving, right?
Absolutely. And if anyone makes a profit, they owe me a cut of it. If they make major losses, then they can just never speak to me about it. Please, please don't at me. And I'll just say, you know, I'm not any of the actual projects that I mentioned, definitely not promoting or advocating for any of them. I'm literally just went as like some of the bigger ones. That does not mean that they're going to translate into successful ones. So just bear that in mind, just a starting point. All right, talking about countdowns. We're kind of like loosely talking about the halving, but you know, there's probably a big chunk of our listeners that are wondering what the hell that even means. So why don't we dig into the second part of this episode, or the second half, some would say, into the into the next story, and we'll dive into the Bitcoin halving.
The halving. You've probably been hearing that a lot if you're anywhere near the space now. But what is it and why should you care? Well, the next Bitcoin halving will likely occur either tomorrow or Saturday, depending on where in the world you are. But what will happen during that? Basically, during a halving, the number of Bitcoin entering circulation every 10 minutes, which is known as a block reward, will drop by half. In this case, it will go from 6.25 Bitcoin to 3.125 Bitcoin. So what are block rewards? Well, for Bitcoin to run, miners use really energy-intensive machines, computers, nodes, however you want to put it, to mint new coins. And then to reward that work and the energy that they're expending with their machines, which today, honestly, if we're being real, it takes place mostly in huge data centers around the world. The miners are rewarded with bitcoins or block rewards. So basically, a miner secures the network using a bunch of compute power, mostly coming from data centers. And then the reward that they get for doing that is every 10 minutes, a block reward is released. Right now, it's 6.25 Bitcoin. So that's new Bitcoin entering circulation. After the halving, that will go down to 3.125 Bitcoin every 10 minutes entering into circulation in the form of a block reward for miners. I know that
So what you're telling me here, Austin, is while the rest of our governments around the world are turning up the money printers, Bitcoin is slowing theirs down. Isn't that right? Yeah.
That is correct, and that's irreversible. It's not something that can be changed. It's a programmatic change that is baked into Bitcoin's code, and it's actually intended to create scarcity over time. This is a big part of why so many people are interested in Bitcoin, especially people that have experienced rampant inflation and money printing, which I think most of us have experience with now after the last few years. This programmatic change happens every 210,000 blocks. So basically, every 210,000 blocks, a halving occurs. Just so happens to be that occurs roughly every 4 years. So as a result, it's happened three times since 2009, which is when Bitcoin was created. Back in 2009, the block reward was 50 Bitcoin every 10 minutes. Think about that, Matt.
Oh man, you know, I was chatting to some of my colleagues at Kraken recently, and we were reminiscing around like some of the old stuff, and we were looking back at one of the old Bitcoin faucets from like early 2012, I think it was, and you could just, it would just give you 4 Bitcoin for free, just, you know, to just like, it's like, oh, that would be nice. Unfortunately, when I went onto Wayback Machine, it didn't work anymore, which was a shame. That'd been a nice little hack. But yeah, it's beautiful. I think, you know, a lot of the attention, when you think about issuance and inflation in crypto, largely doesn't actually focus around Bitcoin. And we think about stuff like ETH that doesn't have this like fixed supply, but actually is now moving into, has this like disinflationary effect. And I think, like, you know, Bitcoin is obviously inflationary, but this like programmatic reduction in its inflation rate and ultimately the dynamic it plays on its supply is a core fundamental part of like Bitcoin as a commodity and how it impacts price. And we see this in cycles and how this plays out. What I think is going to be particularly interesting is how this plays out over this cycle, because we've had this really quite ahead of schedule, triggered by the Bitcoin ETF flood of capital that's come in from the institutional side, hitting Bitcoin all-time highs that traditionally in all of the previous cycles happened post the Bitcoin halving. And what it seems right now is that the Bitcoin halving itself has been a bit of a, albeit it's happening tomorrow, but I think it's probably going to be a bit of a sideways slash sell the news event as we then kind of have the slightly slower grind up in price over time. But, you know, I think it's the beautiful thing about Bitcoin. It's coded in. And yeah, you know, it's predictable, and I don't know of any other asset like it.
Yeah, it's so coded in and so predictable that this entire process of halvings, we even know when the end date is. It'll end once the number of Bitcoin in circulation reaches 21 million. And as you may know, 21 million is the hard cap on the number of Bitcoin that will ever be in circulation. Once there are 21 million Bitcoin minted, there won't be any more created. The general estimate is that this will occur sometime near the year 2140. So it's a long ways off. But
yeah, I wonder what there'll be more of then, humans or BTC. That's the. Will we have just blown ourselves up by then? Yeah, which will be the scarcer asset?
Oh yeah. Well, okay, so
note.
All right, so aside from Matt's doom and gloom left turn of the episode, this is actually quite compelling, right? This idea that these halvings occur every 210,000 blocks, which is roughly every 4 years, that there is a hard cap on the number of Bitcoin that will ever go into circulation, that this creates intentional scarcity over time, and that tomorrow, that number of block rewards is going to go down by half from 6.25 to 3.125 BTC. So why should you care about this? Well, first and foremost, and perhaps most obviously, this does mean that Bitcoin will become more scarce because fewer coins will be minted by miners, putting fewer Bitcoins on the market. So, of course, that is going to drive up the potential value of Bitcoin. And historically, it has. Bitcoin's value has gone up every time after a halving event, but it usually doesn't happen immediately. Before the first halving in 2012, Bitcoin was priced at $12.35. 1 year later, it was at $964. So that's an increase of over 7,700%. Now, that
rookie,
didn't happen
rookie
immediately.
Rookie numbers.
Yeah, I know. No kidding. That change didn't happen immediately. There seems to be a lag that is involved in that. So you have to look at it on like roughly a 1 year scale. The same thing happened in July of 2016 when we had the next halving. Bitcoin at that point had dropped to $663 by then, but 1 year later it was at $2,500. And then the most recent halving was in May of 2020 when Bitcoin was priced at $8,500. A year later, it was exceeding $50,000 during the bull run. This time around, even traditional finance institutions are throwing out predictions that are coming in around the 90K mark for Bitcoin this year alone. Part of the reason for this, perhaps, is maybe the third factor behind why you should care, and it's something that Matt touched on a little bit earlier, which is that a big difference this time around is that more sophisticated institutional investors like BlackRock and Fidelity and so on and so forth are now involved. And this is due to the SEC's approval of Bitcoin ETFs. So a lot of big money is coming in. That's why we've seen some of the bull run and some of the volatility that we've had over the course of the past few months. And I think that we'll continue to see that going forward after the halving event.
I agree. And, you know, this time is different, right? And I know that's a meme, but here's why, right? Here's what isn't different, right? If we just get aside from the fact that, you know, the number goes up each halving, there is something that is worth paying attention to here that in these numbers, and that the relative increase in each of those past three halvings that you talked about and the year following the halving, the relative increase has dramatically decreased, right? That's 7,700 percent increase in 2012 was much lower when you fast forward to the July 2016 piece of like $663 up to 2,500, right? You're talking, what's that, like 700%, something like that, right? Ballpark. And then May 2020, you know, Bitcoin's priced at 8,500 and going up to like 50K, right? So again, it's like, you know, probably about a 6X, right? So it's each of these times they're driving up in value on a relative level, smaller amounts. And I think we see that happen a lot more here. I think is going to be the same. I think, you know, the relative increase is going to be smaller again. And it wouldn't be, I mean, if we go from what, like the roughly kind of, where are we at now? About 60K, right? At the time of the halving. You know, even like a 100% increase would be a great outcome, right? And that'd be significantly lower, right, than previous. And I think even, you know, if we're saying 90K, right, that's like what, like a much, much smaller amount. It's like a 50% increase, right? So now obviously everyone's going to be speculating. So that's what's the same, actually, even though people might think that that's different. Here's what's different this time. The investor base of Bitcoin has dramatically shifted in a way that's actually never happened before, in that some of the single largest holders of Bitcoin are institutional investors now. It's never been the case, right? And a lot of the biggest rallies are always driven by retail. So what we often see is these periods of, like, you know, consolidation into a parabolic rise. It's like very dramatic. And similarly, in the down markets, which will come, right? Like, we will have a down market. The drawdowns have usually been, you know, 85, 90%. Like, it's like very dramatic downtrends. And that's played out every single cycle. I think what's going to happen this time is, with this institutional base and with more Bitcoin being allocated into like passive investing, where you'll see a lot more rebalancing and short-term profit taking versus long-term like hodlers of BTC, is that we will see a slower grind to the top, and it will be far less parabolic big jumps. I think we just grind up gradually, like in still we could see these like big jumps on single days, but nothing to the scale that we've seen before. And on the inverse of that, when we move into the inevitable bear market territory, right? Nothing goes up forever. I think the drawdowns will be far less severe. I think we have a slow grind bleed down, but I'd be surprised if we see the same 70 to 90% drawdowns. I think they'll be less severe, right? I still think we could easily see 50% drawdowns, right? And like, but I don't think it's going to be severe. And I think that's what we will start to see with this new investor base. And we're going to have to navigate some of that. And I you know, we'll look back at this episode in a couple of years and see how that's played out. But I think of anything that I have the most kind of conviction on in this cycle, it's this. And I think we're already starting to see it in places.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing when you add the factor of the institutional investors. You know, it creates a quasi-stabilizing mechanism. You have more people than ever today that have exposure to Bitcoin, perhaps without even knowing it, you know, because of the money that they have parked with these institutional investors and the way that now they're diversifying into assets like Bitcoin, which they couldn't do previously. So that is a stabilizing mechanism. And I think that, you know, will there continue to be volatility in Bitcoin? Absolutely. Way more volatility than a traditional commodity or asset would usually be exposed to, right? We're not saying that it's completely stabilizing or that the volatility is going away. But I'll be honest with you, that's also kind of what makes Bitcoin fun, as long as you approach it with the right mentality that we've always talked about, which is whatever you put in, you should be willing to lose entirely. And then, you know, you can relax a little bit and watch the volatility and see it as an opportunity, you know, if not a little bit of entertainment. And I know that there's many people listening to this that don't view it that way. They're way, way, way more involved, way deeper. It's higher stakes for them.
I think, you know, to that point, I think some people may not feel like that's the case where because they've built a resilience to it, right? And they've grown accustomed to the like, objectively insane volatility that Bitcoin expresses as an asset. And here's my take, right? So you mentioned there, right, like that volatility will remain in Bitcoin. And I completely agree. What I think we are going to see by the end of this cycle is that Bitcoin will begin to shed its reputation as a high risk asset and move into just the risk asset category, in the same sense that, like, you know, in times and periods of distress, like people flood to gold, gold expresses volatility, but nothing on the scale of BTC, but it's still a volatile asset. That's the kind of level. And that's what institutional investors want to see, right? And I think we are going to see this shift in, like, the bounds of volatility. And to call on, like, one of your other pieces, right, where you start to see this volatility go down, it's somewhat of a blessing and a curse, right? Like, this is good for Bitcoin long term. But for anyone that's always historically been in the crypto space, we kind of love the volatility. It's a beautiful place to trade within, right? And the blessing of all of this institutional capital is that, you know, volatility reduces, it becomes a slightly more stable asset and actually is better from the long-term liquidity profile that you want from an asset like this. The downside is that, you know, the more that Bitcoin is allocated into things like passive funds, the worse it is for price discovery. And that is just a fact, right? So any asset that you have inside these like large passive funds, they're going to see less of these explosive parabolic like price discovery moments. And actually you'll have like, okay, you may have these like breakouts and then a grind and then things flatten out. And we see a lot more sideways action. We've seen already Bitcoin hit on 3 consecutive occasions, new all-time highs in the past 2 months. But we've never really felt like it's going to like blow off top and go parabolic, right? Like, so we'll see how this plays out. But I'm positive about this. I like this. And I think it's going to usher in a new wave of like slightly more confident retail investors as a result of all of this, because it's just going to be less explosive. Now, that doesn't extend to the rest of the crypto space, but and there's still going to be lots of room for playing around in high volatility there. But I think this is a level of maturation that we're going to start to see in Bitcoin's timeline.
Yeah. And look, I mean, it's been 15 years. You know, of Bitcoin with high volatility. And in many ways, Bitcoin is sort of the first mover, the predictor for where, you know, a lot of the crypto space will go, not always in terms of innovation, but certainly in terms of, you know, market trends, perceptions, things like that, especially with the you know, broader investor base. And so I think you're right, Matt, like there needs to be a stabilizing mechanism for this to be viable long-term and frankly, to be taken seriously. I think in the grand scheme of things, 15 years is not that long, especially when we're talking all the way out to 2040. And we'll look back on this and say, wow, that was like a really, really volatile entry to something that, you know, eventually stabilized at least to a certain degree, if not entirely. And hey, you know, we're still in the middle of the party time. That's for sure. Yeah. And to your point, this is like one aspect of the market, and there's, you know, what happens here, I think, does serve as a predictor mechanism for the rest of the market, but it definitely doesn't change the fact that there's still going to be a lot of uncertainty and volatility in other cryptos and other pieces of technology in this space. So I think it's nice to see the stabilizing factor that institutional investors are going to have on Bitcoin. And it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out with the halving in particular. I mean, we haven't seen something like this happen before.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's going to be fascinating. And I'm really excited to see how the next, in particular, 2 weeks play out. You know, eyes on the prize long term, but it's going to be really interesting to watch price action happen post-halving. But with that, let's wrap things up. I know everyone's going to have to get their party gear on and get everything all set up for their halving parties. So, you know, we'll give you some time and space to do that. Happy halving, everyone. And yeah, we'll look forward to the next one in 4 years' time when we're all definitely kind of recording this podcast from our Lambos. So, or our super yachts, who knows? All right, Austin, it's been a pleasure. I'll see you next week.
See you then, Matt.
The contents of the Decrypting Crypto podcast should not be used and are not intended as investment advice. Please do your own due diligence before making any investment, cryptocurrency or otherwise.